I'm Matthew.
I'm Marty.
I'm Carlos.
And we are the Heroes 3. Welcome to Heroes 3, the bi-weekly podcast where three friends explore the best, worst, and everything in between in the world of Asian cinema. And this week we are continuing our look at Thai cinema with 2008's Chocolate. Also directed by our director from last week, Prachya Pinkaway. I think that's how you say it. I really should have looked it up.
Ooh.
But anyways, it's the same guy that directed Ong Bak.
Yeah.
Yes.
And also features martial arts choreography by Panarottì Krai.
Yeah.
And it stars Jija. She has a full name, but they were shorter.
Yanin. Vismistananda,
that's it. Yeah. Jija. I think Jinja Mistananda is how they put it in the credits, but yeah. But she's the young actress that stars in this. This is a bonkers movie. It's a very good follow-up to Ong Bak in a lot of different ways. This was your pick, Carlos. So why'd you bring this one to us?
Yeah, just another little kind of taste test and I thought that Chocolate would be the next choice. You mentioned Prachya Pinkaway, and I feel like more than a director, he's also kind of like a creative collaborator with Panna. And they made a point to want to do a female-led film after the success of Ong Bak and, you know, a couple of other productions. So I mentioned the Born to Fight spiritual successor / kind of remake, and during production and during like casting calls, they were introduced to Jija, and they liked her so much that they wanted to make a vehicle for her. So this is the result of that. And I think the interesting thing that we'll talk about here also is that it's not just, hey, it's another kind of action thing. It is. But the difference here is that they're focusing on a main character with a mental disability. And it's really interesting to me. In a way, you know, we've experienced a lot with Hong Kong cinema and different kind of representations in movies. But I think this is a very kind of heartful, kind of honest take.
Yeah, I think it's heart in a really good place.
Yes, I was going to say it has its heart in the right place. It's definitely not amazing, but it's, you know, it has hearts in the right place.
Mm-hmm.
Never mind. Well, we'll get to that at the end. But
no, it's okay. I think, you know, this is going to be a little bit of a smaller episode, and we can play real loose.
Kind of hop around. Things. And luckily, Chocolate is pretty accessible nowadays. At least,
It's on Amazon Prime
in North
right
America.
Now.
Yeah, it should be in Amazon Prime, and
that's how I watched it.
Yeah, pretty good shape.
Yeah, riding the wave post the success of Ong Bak internationally, where it was released on DVD and pretty widely available. Like, I mean, honestly, if you go to a resale shop or look it up online, you can find it really cheap on DVD.
Yeah, totally.
And the DVD is a pretty bare bones release. And I did, you know, honestly, I've never seen like what they call the original cut of the film. And I don't know if it's very available, but there are some ideas in the original cut that they kind of squeeze out of the widely available release for obvious reasons. And one of them is that with this character, I guess in a way similar to Panna's stories, where he's very influenced by the martial arts movies that he watched. This character is also influenced by martial arts cinema.
She's influenced by Panna's movies.
Yeah.
And I think also, are there Bruce Lee films that are in the Thai version that are cut out here?
Right. And that's like I said, I haven't
seen
these cuts.
Which I'm guessing was like a rights issue thing.
Yeah. But yeah, knowing that and knowing what we see in the film, there's the first couple of major action sequences featuring Zen, the main character. Has her fighting in an ice factory in Thailand. Another time where we can mention the Big Boss, and it's definitely an influence for the scene.
I need to just rewatch the Big Boss.
Her first catalyst is that there's a guy, and she's kind of seeing him through like blurry double vision, and he does the Bruce Lee classic nose, you know, gesture. Yeah. And earlier, I mean, you can, if you're looking for it, you can kind of see the chopping up and editing of the sequence. But like Matthew is saying, she's watching Ong Bak. Actually, she watches a scene from The Protector too in one moment. Yeah. But then, like the very next shot, you're hearing like the distinctive Bruce Lee whooping,
or like an imitator
of it. Like, so it's
legally distinct.
Yeah. Bruce Lee. So they basically, they retained as much as they could to kind of indicate that like, oh, she watches Bruce Lee as well. But, but yeah, it's a little hidden for kind of legal protection. Right. Here. But so, I love how you're connecting that to Panna. And, I mean, I think, yeah, one thing that I was just really, kind of taken with watching these movies in succession and thinking about that, you know, reimagining of Born to Fight, you know, we've talked about the kinds of things that would happen with Hong Kong action success. And usually it's you kind of recreate the same movie and everyone and their brother and sister are kind of imitating the movie that you just put out and trying to do it as fast as possible. What I like here is this really seems like a case where Ong Bak was this spearhead and like everyone in the family sort of gets a paycheck kind of a thing. It's like they're kind of all these passion projects that were made possible by Ong Bak, and they're really kind of making the most with it. And I like how you're kind of, I don't know, connecting some of the maybe kind of personal origins of this. Also, there's a really interesting sort of forward like title card that is credited to Pracha. And he seems to reference, in the translation, they refer to like special children. So it seems like he's inspired by some kind of real world story of like a group of special needs kids.
Yeah, you can definitely tell that there is something that affected him personally that was playing a part in him wanting to make this film, which is pretty cool. Yeah, so I mentioned the kind of Bruce Lee stuff, but the next action scene following that is a warehouse scene. And if you're paying close attention to the style of action, besides the trademarks that we're seeing from Panna's stunt team, you do get some Jackie Chan flavor in how she's handling.
Yeah, oh, this is very Jackie Chan.
Yeah, her enemies. There's some gags with a locker, in and out of a locker, using the doors and stuff. There's hopping over some chairs, and there's some kind of acrobatics involved. And yeah, this was also like something supposedly, I apologize that I haven't seen this version. I honestly don't know how widely available that is, and I would love to watch it if anybody's got a clue that's listening to send it to me, because they say
here's the number3podcast@gmail.com.
yeah, they say that they reference Jackie Chan films for this stuff. And the other thing that I noticed too is that early on in the film, she's got a personality quirk where she's tossing candy into her mouth, and the way that she's doing it is like just like Jackie Chan in Armor of God. So in Armor of God, Jackie will like pop these like pills or candies into his mouth, and in the same way that she's doing it. And actually she does she does it like one step above, where she's doing kind of more involved bouncing. And they use computer animation in this film in an interesting way too. So there's some special effects. There's some special effects with her reflexes. So at the beginning of the film, you see her growing up, and the first thing is that she like eats a computer animated fly, which is hilarious to me.
it's real bad.
Yeah. But then beyond that, she's almost has like a mutant ability that she can sense, you know, things coming at her. Her heightened senses are a big part in her skills. You get to see that in a way where some special effects are used to show things flying at her, and then she catches them in one hand. And honestly, I think it's quick enough. I mean, obviously, you know, when you're watching it, paying attention for a podcast, you're like, oh yeah, you can see that. But I mean, it serves a purpose.
It's like, it's almost kind of in the same neighborhood as like, you know, some of the Kung Fu Hustle visual effects.
Definitely.
That kind of thing. And there is like a, yeah, I don't know. There's a kind of funny little charm to it, I think, but
I'd also say that for like, there's like a short animated sequence too. It's kind of like a dream. Oh, that she has.
That's pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah. It's cool.
It's in it. Yeah. It's CG. It's like really stylized CG in a time when there wasn't a lot of super stylized CG.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, that's that weird. I know there's got to be someone out there that's got a lot of information about the history of animation in Thailand, and I just got to find it. But
we'll get there. Yeah,
we'll figure it out.
Yeah, for sure.
That speaks English, I should say. I'm sure there's plenty that are in Thai or whatever. But
the other thing I wanted to ask you guys is, did you know that there is a Godzilla connection with this film?
Oh, I did. Like the actor who plays her father, right? Or her biological father.
Yeah. So Hiroshi Abe is in Godzilla 2000. And this is a scene that I didn't want to spoil for you guys, but since we're here talking about him, I'll let you know. And it's honestly from the Millennium era of Godzilla films, like my favorite scene in all of these movies.
Oh,
and it's
wow.
Like the end of the film where he plays this military guy, and you get to the point where Godzilla literally has like a face off against a human being, and he's literally standing on top of a building and he yells at him,
"Godzilla!"
And Godzilla looks directly at him, and there's a dramatic pause, and he smashes the building.
Awesome.
It's amazing. It's amazing. It's like one of my favorite things ever.
He has a great look, though. Yeah, I could see him really having a staring contest with Godzilla.
Very intense.
And Abe's character here does something that I don't think I've ever seen in a fight sequence, but it really kind of makes a lot of sense. Like there's this, we're jumping kind of all over the timeline here, having some fun with it, but the most elaborate kind of fight scene, which takes place fittingly at the end of the movie, he comes right in with a gun blazing. It's basically his approach is to like fire every round in the clip until it's done, and then he goes to hand in hand. Hand to hand once he's exhausted it. And it's like, oh, I've never actually seen that. Like,
It's in a funny sequence,
but it kind of makes sense. It's like, I'm going to start with like the most destructive thing as long as
it's
I
very
can.
Very video gamey.
Yeah, very video gamey. It's like using your resources. And
It's almost shocking when you see it because we're
trained. Really. It's just like, that's not allowed.
Yeah, for a sequence like this where it's like, okay, this is the big final fight in the big dojo area, and all the thugs are gonna come at this guy one by one, and he's like, no, I'm gonna just shoot you right away, and you're like, whoa. we can talk about the movie a little bit and basically kind of fly around. We have been jumping around a little bit, but the basic premise of this film, it honestly has kind of a heroic bloodshed vibe to the beginning of the movie.
Oh, sure, yeah.
It does. I was kind of thinking this, it feels kind of like a Yakuza movie or like a John Woo kind of thing with lots of guns and like, you know, love and violence mixing in with each other.
Yeah, definitely. There's a basically a standoff that begins the film between two opposing like mob factions. You've got the Japanese Yakuza and you've got like a Thai mob, and it seems
And once again Pracha does a really I don't know, this really effective kind of like gradual reveal of the frame, similar to Ong Bak and the tree and the climbers, where you know, we kind of started on these close-ups opposing of this man and this woman, and then eventually we're pulling back and we're seeing that they're at gunpoint, and then eventually revealing more to the image.
And there's an interesting like narrative device that basically makes for bookends of the film where they're focusing on Masashi. He has like this fascination with imperfection based on the narration, and they focus on the female in this scene who is like who would become the mother, and her name is Zin, and the actress, her name is Amara Siripong, and she's got like a scar on her eyebrow. And
it's Zin with an I, not Zin with an E.
Yeah, there's Zin.
The daughter is Zin with an E.
So they are an opposing forces, but they eventually find love within each other. Mm-hmm. And but that's also like kind of the bad part of their relationship, because the mob boss from the Thai side is like jealous, or you know, he's possessive of her, and that creates kind of like this drama throughout the whole film. And eventually they have a child, and Masashi ends up leaving them. They explain it, but basically he's not anywhere throughout the film until like maybe midway and towards the end. And it focuses on Zin and Zen, and she's trying to make her life for her daughter outside of crime, but crime continues to pester them. And this Thai mob boss is basically keeping tabs on them the whole time, and there's a really kind of ruthless scene at the beginning where he chops off her toe, like as like a punishment for her betrayal.
This is following him just like involuntarily chopping off his own toe, which is like presumably out of the like sadism of his weird sense of balance or whatever. Actor, I think, is really strong in this. There's some interesting choices where I think they maybe depict the kind of internationality of the like Thai against Japanese characters. Like they speak to each other in English, but you know, both of these gentlemen are, you know, it's very thickly accented and maybe a little tough to believe this is like their kind of, I don't know, involuntary speaking.
That's their lingua franca. But they speak Japanese in the Japanese scenes. Sorry, it's fancy words. It's the mutual language they speak, Carlos.
Yeah, totally.
Matthew's Italian.
That's
was that Italian? I'm just kidding. Was...
but actually continuing with that the thing that kind of further makes it like firmly Japanese and firmly Thai is that the Japanese gang is, you know, these very like Yakuza thug kind of people like you're thinking of. And the Thai gangster is all Katui that we've seen before, or Lady Boys that we've seen in Twinkle Twinkle Lucky Stars. We also saw Killer Katui in that one.
That's right.
Yeah, and I think to the movie's credit, it's never addressed. It's never really...
brought up. It's really funny.
And I think it's kind of... you know, we only have two of Pratchett's films to draw from here, but I think there's some interesting kind of flavor similarities we're seeing across both of them. And one of them, I think, is like just lots of interesting texture and surprise to characters and their backgrounds that aren't really part of, you know, the fabric of the plot or whatever, but just, I don't know, add a lot of detail and surprise and... I don't know, just personality to this thing.
And honestly, I think it's a cool way to handle like a threatening character, because you know, it's definitely not something that anyone would expect, but it's definitely a threatening idea. And I you know, like they're badasses. Like they seem like
they're brutal.
We're gonna mess you up. So yeah, that's pretty cool. But Zin has a child, and this child. Very quickly, you understand that this child has disabilities, so you understand that it's going to be a little more difficult to raise this child, and you see that pretty well in this character's interactions with her daughter. And I think it's pretty cool. It's not something you'd expect in an action movie. You know what I mean? Like, I like that they're showing the spotlight on this, and actually, in a way, this is going to drive the action throughout the rest of the film. So,
and really, like, points for a pretty original premise, like you're saying, like for an action hero. Thinking about, you know, our last film, Ong Bak, there we have this kind of like country bumpkin who has to venture off to the city, you know, so it's like a very classic sort of fable, but also a great vehicle for this actor who's an incredible stunt performer, but fairly green as an actual, you know, like actor and dramatist or whatever. And we have kind of a similar situation here. And so the fact that you have this character that's meant to be like very low affect, very low emotion, though, of course, there, you know, there are some opportunities for her to kind of depict, you know, some of the more extreme difficulties of her experience. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think there's quite a bit that's clever about the premise. I mean, just broadly speaking, you don't get the sense that you're in is maybe kind of carefully manicured a production as Ong Bak.
Yes.
Kind of contrasting the two, I can't say for sure, but you almost get the sense that Ong Bak is kind of almost like more carefully storyboarded or shot listed or something. It's just, I feel like there's a lot of intention and kind of composition kind of throughout the whole film. And I think you get great flashes of some of that same taste here in Chocolate, but it also feels like quite a bit of the movie is maybe a bit more slapdash.
And the budget does, yeah, definitely feels like it's a lower budget situation. Totally. The sets and kind of the way the scenes play out in a way almost feel like a TV movie at times. The action is cool though. Like, I think the action's framed really well, and
really well.
You get and a dang, lot.
It makes me appreciate this era because it's like everything is still shot on film. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, we'd rolled out some like feature films like shot on digital media by this point, but I mean, one thing that I still feel like is I just really struggle with a lot of like digitally shot action stuff is the. And not to get on too big of a tangent, but like the way a lot of productions fix their shutter speed for these things just is not what we're used to in like the whole history of
cinema.
Action cinema. And so you can get these kind of weird, it's just a kind of a weird sense of motion. And I think, you know, a decade or so ago, earlier, I think there were some other issues with the sensor as far as motion goes. But honestly, something like this, even if, you know, we are operating with like a lower budget, I mean, some of these sequences just look incredible. And there's just, I don't know, the motion is just so gorgeous. The contrast is so strong. And there's also, there's quite a lot that they get for free. You know, you think of the kind of grimy look that, like, say the Wachowskis and David Fincher were like kind of successfully nailing in their movies of this period. I think Pratch is getting that kind of with just some of the raw ingredients of these Thai locations. This kind of grittiness that it's maybe bolstered by a little bit of production design, but it's honestly just kind of natural. And when the movie looks good, I think it looks quite good, but yeah, it's probably worth managing our expectations a little bit, kind of coming off of the heels of Ong Bak.
Yeah.
Yeah, the big thing for me is that each of the action shots, like each of the action set pieces are really cool.
Yeah.
But a lot of times the connection between the scenes feels weird. Like it feels very like, okay, we are here now. Now we are doing this part in the warehouse. Now we're doing this part in the warehouse. Like, there's not as much like continuity between a lot of the shots that makes it feel a little more disjointed.
No, yeah. I like that. And yeah, that's a good way of putting it. And I think there's like a pretty good contrivance that just thinking about the story that kind of gets our action going, which is,
yeah, cool.
So Zin, the mother character, it turns out is battling with a terminal illness, battling cancer. And so this is kind of a motivation for Zen and her kind of buddy sidekick. And I like this character. This also feels like a Ong Bak-ian kind of.
Mm-hmm. It is, yeah. It reminds me a lot of the
character.
The side character.
And he's kind of like her
mom or moon.
Yeah. Yeah, he's kind of like her big brother protector. Well, he ends up coming across this like date book ledger that Zin had hidden away. And it turns out that there are all these people over town that owe her some pretty big money. So if they could collect that money, then they could maybe help pay for her operations. And so this ends up being kind of the thrust for the action in the movie. It's like they need to shake down some really heavy guys, and this like forces, you know, Zen to kind of like go into superhero fighter mode to basically beat up legions of henchmen that are protecting the boss of each of these establishments.
They have their first interaction, and the guy, like, he's counting on an abacus which is funny.
Yeah.
He throws it at her. And that's when we get that cool animation sequence where she, like, it's like this little puppet version of herself that's fighting these dudes. And then that's when we get our big boss style ice factory fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's cool to me that you've got this very small framed character. But as far as Jija's background, she had like taekwondo background when she auditioned. But then in preparation for this film, Pana trained her in like different martial arts, so like Muay Thai and gymnastics and stunt work stuff. She they say there's a making of featurette that is basically like what I think are like basically commercial vignettes that are compiled into like this 10-minute sequence, and they talk about how she had pretty much like 2 years of serious training but almost 4 years of total training to prepare her for this movie. And you do get to see her do a lot of these similar athletic kind of Muay Thai kind of flips and kind of half like tricking, half Muay Thai situation stuff. But yeah, I think especially in this ice factory scene, seeing her do her kicks, you can really tell that she's taekwondo trained, because she's got like very straight like high kicks, and she's landing with like her toes, like she's hitting targets on the, you know, the bad guys that she's kicking very precisely. And I think that's something that I really got enjoyment out of seeing. And she does a couple of times, like the first time that she does any action, she's beating up some kind of bullies that are like messing around with their street performing, and she does this really awesome high kick where the dude's standing on a higher platform than she is, and she does like a jumping high kick, and it looks so good. And that happens like in the warehouse scene. But seeing the kind of tight form of Jija's performance put to that kind of Bruce Lee kicking style too is really fun. There is a bit of suspension of belief when it comes to seeing this kind of smaller character hit some pretty heavy, dense guys. And you can,
yeah, as far as like the force of the kicks, it's power. Really interesting when it like contrasted with maybe what we're used to in kind of like a Hong Kong environment, where like, let's say if we're talking about Yuen Woo-ping or Sammo Hung, and we mentioned how basically every actor ends up coming across looking really great, and there's very judicious use of doubling and moves that really sell that person's strengths. I feel a little bit that Jija is kind of she's given a super tall order, I think, in a lot of the action sequences, and I think some of them are, I don't know if they're always like super well scaled to like what it is she does best.
Yeah, if you think about all of,
I don't
the
know,
sequence,
like I definitely don't want to be negative, because I think she comes across looking great, but there's actually very little doubling, for instance, for one. Right. So it's like she's really kind of forced to kind of pull a lot of weight in all of Pana's routines, and I think they're very good routines. But yeah, there's just maybe a little bit of just subtle amount of like maybe kind of leading the witness a little bit.
It's the power to me. Like you really do, you miss the kind of sense of power that you see, like, you know, they like what you're saying is like they're dropping her into this framework that they've built with you know, from going back to Born to Fight and Ong Bak, and you got this very hard-hitting style that you want to portray, but it's using a very smaller, a much smaller performer. And I mean, every fight sequence is her fighting multiple assailants. There's really hardly any moment.
There's like one one-on-one fight in the movie, and everything else is her fighting just countless dudes.
Yeah, it's just like a constant line of goons that she's beating up. So, I mean, in that sense, it is one-on-one, but it's like a bunch.
She's definitely playing younger, but Jija is, I think, like 23 or something in this, like when this was filmed, but she's just a very small woman. But she does some incredible stuff. And they play with her size a lot too, in some fun ways.
Yeah.
Like in the warehouse scene, she's like getting through these nooks and crannies that the guys can't, and making these big jumps.
There's also something cool with just like she's always just kind of wearing her casual like lounger.
Yeah, she's wearing
house
like pajama wear pants and what.
And honestly, it's not something you've really seen before, and mm-hmm. especially in like elaborate fight sequences. Yeah. And there's something really cool about that. I do think when you know, there's actually a lot of inventiveness and some kinds of approaches you haven't really seen before. I would say, especially start seeing that in the second big set piece in the factory when she's like sliding in between spots that only she could fit through, and mm-hmm. all that stuff I think is like, yeah, super, super exciting.
Yeah. The other thing too that I like about this kind of sequence of basically like three major action sequences in a row is that each one has its own like color language. So the ice factory is very cold and blue, and the factory, the warehouse is very warm and orange. And then the last one that you see here is like a butcher basically. And that's very red color graded.
Yeah.
And we mentioned Stephen Chow earlier, but there's a couple of knife gags that are similar.
I literally wrote the gag where the guy gets a cleaver stuck in his shoulder. And then later another cleaver gets thrown at him. Yeah. I was like, that is such a Stephen Chow joke.
Yeah, totally.
It's funny too, during that sequence. I mean, in each of these sequences, she runs through all of the goons. And the last thing she does is either they give her the money or she like takes it and goes back home. And I like that they make a point in the last one that the guy says that all this was for like 5,000 baht, which I think is the currency.
It's like $500 or something.
It's not even, it's not, like $130 or something, which by our standards now, which is pretty funny.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah.
And sure, their medical bills for all the horrible infections they're going to be getting cost more than that.
Oh, man. Oh, dude, speaking of medical bills, also, I think it might be fun to kind of jump around here. And it does make me want to watch it again. But at the end of the film, we're treated to something that are it's not the typical kind of NGs. It's almost a little bit of like a don't do this at home kids sort of like warning reel. And I don't know, I really kind of appreciated what like Panna and Pritchard are doing here, because we're seeing some stunts that went wrong. Actually, some stunts that went right is in they're the keeper shots in the film, but we're seeing like just what the injuries were. And
it's so
they're
fun.
They're really extensive. I mean, Jija has some really rough stuff, but plenty of the crew took some really difficult falls. And I think, I don't know, even if it's your first time watching it, I think having that in mind as you're going through these sequences, that similar to what we were talking about with Ong Bak, it's like if it looks like real contact, like you likely are seeing real contact through this.
There's so many of them on, and the credit stuff is people, it shows the cool shot and then it shows a bunch of medics all around them and they're bleeding from their head and you're like, no, it doesn't hurt. It doesn't hurt.
Yeah, and Jija has a lot of the attitude of like, kind of put me back in, coach, kind of thing.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, I really want to check out other movies that she's in, because it's funny. I was looking through her, because this is the first film she's in. I was looking through and I was like, oh, she's not in that many movies. But then I realized, no, she's in like 10 movies over 15 years. That's like a normal amount of movies.
Totally.
I'm so broken by our Hong Kong guys that are at 15 movies in like 2 years.
I think it's called Raging Phoenix or Rising Phoenix. I think it's Raging
Phoenix. Yeah, Raging Phoenix. Yeah.
That's got like some like very breakdancey, kind of dancey vibes in the choreography too, which is pretty fun and worth checking out. But yeah, as far as this film goes, you've got this struggle between Zen and the mobsters, and Zin and her struggles with her health, and eventually all of this stuff builds to a head where the Thai mobster is he like sends her back her toe, which is crazy.
That's so gross. It is a power move.
Yep. And
also the Thai gangster is credited as number 8.
Yeah, and they never
refer to it, but they say it in the credits. It says number 8, and I was like, okay, sure.
Yeah.
Number 8.
Eventually, Moom gets wounded by the gang, and he gets captured. Zin goes with the Zen to the mob boss to get him back. And that basically sets up the final sequence of the film, which is pretty much like the last 20 minutes, almost half an hour, where you've got that big kind of dojo sequence. And Masashi gets involved also because she's trying to connect with him. And then he finds out that she's in trouble and he makes his way to Thailand to help out. And there's like a major fight sequence where they introduce a character on the Thai side that has like this kind of physical quirk that I don't know how to really describe it. Although
the Wikipedia calls it Tourette's, which I guess it's like lots of twitching and
He's twitching. Yes.
But it's just, it's really funny to me that this movie has autism versus Tourette's. That's,
yeah. It's like, and autism wins.
And autism wins, so I don't know.
That's wild.
I have some autistic friends. I'll have to ask them how they feel about that. But
the
twitchy, it's just very strange. It's like a weird scribbled adventures kind of thing.
And
also that you have, it's like this capoeira like thing versus dance. Like more of and a
he's got this thing. This sick like Adidas tracksuit going on
the dude that plays that character is known for being b-boy like breakdancing. His name is Kittikat Kawagal, and they kind of loop him into the film because of his skills. And there's a couple other, I think there's one other guy that I think of that's in this film that he's known for being a fighter in real life. And he's like around this time too. He's got like a head, like a checkered headband and a kind of like some street clothes. She does like that high leaping kick on the rooftop to him. That's like one of like the trailer moments of the film. But that dude's known as being like a world class boxer. Oh yeah, his name is Siramongkol Singh Manasak, and he's a world champion boxer from Thailand. But the thing that's funny to me about him is that in Street Fighter VI, Ryu has like an alternate outfit, and it almost looks exactly the same as what this guy's wearing. It's weird. Awesome. He's got the same kind of jacket, same kind of headband, and which it's very uncharacteristic Ryu, but like they always do that with alternate costumes. But yeah, so this whole like dojo fight gets pretty wild, and this is what we were mentioning earlier where Masashi brought a gun to a sword fight. And but it also turns into this tragic moment where he's trying to protect Zin and she gets stabbed, and it's a fatal wound. And
this, it is cool though, because before she dies, the mom is like, they're kind of at the very beginning, we kind of see that they were kind of like a crime couple kind of they were going
very sensual and,
they're like, it's like them going and, you know, roughing up people for money, intercut with them having sex,
Bonnie and Clyde kind of thing.
And but then this is like them kind of reuniting after years and kind of fighting together a little bit, only for her to be stabbed.
It's very
tragic, but it's such a cool it's a cool set piece.
So it does, it leads to the rooftop, and there's an involved sequence between Jija and two performers.
Which it's interesting, these two women are more like, I don't know, they're not as, I guess, femme as some of the other people we've seen fighting in the other parts of this movie. They're, I don't know, it's a little,
sure I know,
it's just interesting that they're part of the same gang, but they're a little more butch. But
they have this kind of interesting spotlight cool look to them that I don't know who they are, but you can almost kind of get the sense that maybe like they're kind of known like performers.
They seem like maybe they're actually, you know, competitive martial artists, because also it's reminiscent of, I think, the kind of thing that we've seen before when competitive martial artists are having their kind of first go at a screen fight, where you can tell that there's a lot of prowess there. But there's maybe a little bit of gap between kind of like playing the moves to the camera quite right. I don't know. I think still some really inventive stuff here in the sequence, and again, some more kind of squeezing and tight fitting, like and dodging.
A whole bit where they're like crawling underneath these pipes and gratings and everything.
And that's where Jija in real life took like a really bad
isn't it in that
beat?
It's I always love whenever you're watching the outtakes, whenever, you know, it's these two people who look like they're like really vicious, but as soon as one gets hurt, then the other one's like, oh my god, are you okay?
Literally the second after the it's crazy.
Really fun stuff. Cool.
That's actually just before the big dojo scene. It doesn't matter that much.
Oh yeah, but, yeah. Okay, gotcha.
Because the after.
Oh
that
yeah, she comes back to the dojo, and that's when she squares off against the B-boy.
Yeah. And then they're hopping on the side of the building.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to lead us to. The final really cool sequence stuff. Is a very interesting kind of set piece where, you've got all of these thugs and that mob boss trying to basically get away or fight. Zen, and they're on like a building face that has kind of like these kind of tiers to it, and
it's so video gamey.
Yeah, and it's really like a stunt set piece, and there's definitely some fight choreography going on, but it's more about like kind of like this endurance and this kind of athleticism of like navigating the building phase, and you got these
again,
setups.
It feels like an arcade game, like an old like Donkey Kong or
Rampage
or something. Yeah, Rampage. Nice. Yeah, it's people going up and down these tiers, and like you're trying to dodge it and then get in hits when you can. Like it's totally a video game.
Or I think of like the original Double Dragon, where sometimes you're climbing up a ladder in a building to get to a next set of enemies. Mm-hmm. That's something that I really love. But
did you actually? So she plays a video game briefly.
Yeah,
earlier
it's weird.
Oh yeah, with the Super Famicom controller.
Yeah, the Famicom controller. It's definitely a PlayStation or PlayStation 2 game.
It looked to me like something similar to like Jet Li's Rise to Honor, where it's like 3D equivalent of a beat 'em up, but I don't know what it is, and honestly kind of part of me feels like it was made up for the game, for the film, I mean. But it's one of these
I can see that
3D beat 'em up situations where you've got like a mob of like four or five guys attacking one person in a 3D space. And it's a low poly, obviously. But I definitely noticed too that she's playing on a Super Famicom and it's a 3D modeled game, which come on. That's my Simpsons nerd question.
At least she's not like smashing the controller and say like, "Mom, I got to get to the next level."
She is holding it still like you would play a game controller at least, not like moving it all around.
Yeah. Yep. So, but the thing that I wanted to say about this final sequence is that you get a couple of these like hard fall like stunts.
Oh man!
Similar to the opening.
It feels like the multi-story.
Yeah. Crashes that are stay within the frame of the camera. Yeah, man, really.
But
something.
For me, one of the crowning stunts, I think it's a digital effect where actually it's that Ryu looking guy where she kicks him and it looks like he falls like 20 plus feet. And I think it's a digital effect fall. But honestly, I think that it's so well done that it's hard to tell.
There was a fall in the kind of NG's fall of almost a similar height that one dude took who had to end up going to the hospital. Mm-hmm. They show a little clip of like some of the crew visiting him at the hospital.
Yeah,
too.
That's like adorable.
Oh. Yeah.
Yep.
And I knew there was a little bit earlier, you can kind of tell, but there's wire work in this scene too.
which is
really cool. Like a lot of these flips and a lot of the like the big splits, and she does this amazing flying knee.
Oh, amazing. And that in the warehouse sequence, that incredible
split
jump
spin,
just like trailer stuff. Though it does seem like a lot of the wire work is really almost kind of like precautionary and kind of safety measure stuff, which is nice to see.
Yeah, I'm into it. It's something that, we're used to seeing it. And when you do see it, you're like, oh, okay, cool. I think it supports her athleticism. I don't think it makes up for anything. And I don't think it pulls you out of the personality of the action.
And it's like tools of the trade thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were mentioning with Ong Bak that some of the international marketing was like, no wires, chump, that kind of thing. But that's not really coming from the actual crew of the movie.
No.
It's like...
That's definitely Western marketing.
Yeah. Cool. But that's basically like the finale here. You've got that the mob boss, he takes a hard fall. That's it. And
And the mother. The mother dies, and the dad steps up. And
dad steps up.
Earlier, we see he kind of turns in his Yakuza badge to these old men, and now he's. And it's funny in this very last scene where they're at these by all these like wind turbines.
Yeah,
the outfit they put her in makes her look like she's like 8. Which is funny because she looks, you know, more definitely more like teenagery in the rest of the movie, but she looks so young in this last scene.
Yeah, and yeah. Very colorful. I'm sure it's meant to show that it's like she's finally being like cared for in a substantial way. But yeah, really interesting beat and kind of a nice, you know, final, you know, shot composition here as they could sort of walk off into the sunset. But yeah,
that's Chocolate.
That's cool. That's Chocolate. And like I've never tracked down like exactly who cooked up the international title because it's not known as Chocolate.
All the food turns of phrase are just jumping out at me because the film's called Chocolate.
Yeah.
Right. Sorry,
But yeah, I think it's Zen Warrior Within. I think is another title for it, which is like just kind of based after the character. There is this one moment where in the warehouse, I keep wanting to say in the Home Depot fight. But her friend and bodyguard like actually grab some boxes off of the shelf to try to block him, and you see all these boxes labeled chocolate and choco this and chocolate.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's right. Nice.
I thought I was gonna get through this without referencing Willy Wonka, but it's the factory where they're going through all the chocolate bars to try to find the golden ticket.
Yeah, it's a good time. Yeah, definitely. You know, not like a triple A kind of event like Ong Bak was, but I think equally interesting. And definitely if you were enjoying what you were seeing coming out of Thailand, you should check out Chocolate as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a really rewarding.
Yeah, this is definitely more straight to DVD than Ong Bak.
Yeah, well said.
But it's so much fun. It's definitely worth a watch. Thank you so much for checking out this show. If you enjoyed it, then you can check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Blue Sky, and Threads. We are at Here's the Number 3 Podcast on all of them. Do you have a single A direct to DVD action movie that you think would be cool for us to watch? Statistically speaking, Carlos has it on his shelf already, but please let us know. Send it to here's the number 3 podcast@gmail.com. And we have one last Thai film to wrap up this arc of ours. So, Carlos, what is our training for next week?
We're going to continue to eat food with our titles. This is we're moving back a little bit. This is from 2005. And we're going to consume some Tom Yung Gong. This is a mix of many flavors. And again, we're going to have Prachao Pinkao and Tony Ja and Panna involved. Yeah. So this is a good time. And I thought it was worth us jumping back to check this film out. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah, same here.
Actually, whenever I mentioned to my friend Aaron, shout out to Aaron if you're listening to this, that we did Ong Bak, he literally asked, are you doing Tom Yung Gong? And I was like, yes, we are.
Yeah, got to.
But yeah, until next week, this is the movie that's also known as The Protector in the United States.
Yeah, exactly.
We could talk about some version differences. Love version differences. Yeah. So until next week, we're taking a look at Tom Yung Gong. I'm Matthew.
I'm Marty.
I'm Carlos.
And we are the Heroes 3. Remember your training.
Heroes 3 is part of the Mercado Brothers Podcast Network.
And I can't believe we did two in a row this.
We did two podcasts.
Amazing. That was crazy.
Yeah.
I don't feel dead.